What I want to do this afternoon is talk a little bit more about compassion, do a guided meditation where we really expand the practice to include all beings and have a sense of really landing in and radiating that quality of metta. Sorry, I teach metta so much it's hard not to say the word compassion. And then we'll do breakout groups where we'll get into small groups and just talk about this practice and how you're using it, what works for you, what's difficult for you. We'll have some time for questions. So, and we'll be finished by around 4 o'clock. So that's the plan for this afternoon. So one of the things I've been emphasizing, hopefully you're getting, is the importance and the centrality of compassion to the Buddha's teaching, even a necessary practice. Again, the Dalai Lama, some people view him as a bodhisattva of compassion. He says, love and compassion are necessities, not luxuries. Without them, humanity cannot survive. So I just love that straightforwardness of what he feels. This is not, something that's nice for us to do because we're good Buddhists or whatever, or we've got the time. He says, love and compassion are necessities, not luxuries. Without them, humanity cannot survive. And as we've been saying, given the challenges that there are in the world, we see how none of us can survive alone. All of us are so reliant on the goodness and the support and the compassion of others, either in a direct way or in indirect ways. So these teachings are essential for us to develop, to practice, and not separate from the wisdom teachings of the Buddha. As I said, compassion so related to the Four Noble Truths, that the central teaching of the Buddha, that there is suffering and the cause of suffering is grasping. Compassion is almost the opposite of grasping. It's an antidote to the suffering caused by grasping, because with the empathy of compassion, the more we open to our own suffering, the less likely we are to try to take things from others or take what doesn't belong to us, or all the ways that grasping can happen, because the compassion shows us the interconnectedness that is the basic truth, that we're all living in this web of interconnections, all the products of causes and conditions, and that compassion is something that softens the jagged edges of this world, so many places of difficulty and conflict. And compassion allows us to meet and hold that. And at the beginning of the Buddha's life, actually, it wasn't at the beginning. It was once he got, he actually, well, he did begin to teach, because he thought it would be too difficult to teach. It would be vexing. People wouldn't understand. And someone said, no, there are people who will understand. Please go and teach. And so he decided to teach. But once he gained a few disciples and they became established in the Dhamma themselves, he said, go forth for the benefit of the multitude, for the happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the welfare, benefit, and happiness of devas and humans. That's in the Vinaya as a teaching to his first monastic followers. And so that was one of the early, the beginning of spreading of the Buddha's teachings was out of compassion. And the Buddha's whole, the rest of his life was devoted to teaching out of compassion. So compassion is central to what the Buddha taught and practiced, and we are the recipients of that compassion today. So it's not, again, just a nice thing to do, but really pointing to these deep truths of engagement and interconnectedness. It's a practice of connection, as we've been saying. And so, oh, I dropped this. The essence of compassion is opening to, being willing to, open to the suffering in ourselves and others, to open to it and be with it in an as unmediated a way as possible. And out of that willingness, wanting to alleviate suffering. And really a part of our practice is, as I've said, learning to distinguish the true compassionate wish to alleviate suffering and the wanting out of aversion to the suffering to fix or make the suffering go away. So compassion has to start from this place of truly feeling it with equanimity that allows us to stand in balance as we're opening to the difficulty. And then from that place of balance and wisdom, seeing what we can do to act, to support. So as a practice, when we're doing it as a practice, so not in our field of relations and engagement, it's an energetic movement. We start to get familiar with what it's like when we're just sitting with, holding the suffering of ourselves or others. And we're open to it. We're not resisting it. We're not trying to push it away, suppress it, trying to fix it. We're just with it. And then our compassionate action is just the offering of the motivation, the intention of compassion through phrases, through the feeling, through the holding. So I was going to say passive. It's not passive, but we're doing it as a practice. It's a training. So we're learning how to do it in that sense. And this develops the resiliency and the capacity of the heart so that when we are in engagement, we can do it more often from that place of balance, of equanimity, of deep connection, and of deep caring. And that's not easy to do. So that's why we practice. And we practice in our own inner being so that then when we're out in the world and engaged, we have that, we have more capacity to meet the suffering as we're moving about in our relationships. And I've said compassion isn't about pity. It's about, oh, you poor things out there. You know, how can I from up here help you? It's this feeling with, it's seeing the shared kinship and acting out of that. So it is out of a deep sense of connection. And so many great stories of people who have just really changed, you could say changed the world through their bodhisattva actions. One of our local heroes is Reverend Cecil Williams, who, you know, if you live in the Bay Area, you will have heard of him. He's now retired, but he ran Glide Memorial Church for so many years. And so, you know, I've never met him. I don't go to that church, but Jack Cornfield, I think, knows him well and goes there. So I've heard stories, but I just read this online and it's such a powerful story. It said in 1963, Cecil Williams went to Glide Memorial Church, which then had a small white affluent congregation. These congregants didn't share Williams' vision of inclusiveness. Soon they left the church. Williams remained determined. In 1964, he helped create the Council on Religion and Homosexuality, a bold move even by today's standards. Under his leadership, Glide Memorial became a 10,000 member congregation of all races, ages, genders, ethnicities, sexual orientations, and religions. It is the largest provider of social services in the city, San Francisco, serving over 3,000 meals a day, providing AIDS, HIV screenings, offering adult education programs, giving assistance to women dealing with homelessness, domestic abuse, substance abuse, and mental health issues. And I'm sure today it's deeply involved in COVID and supporting people affected by the pandemic. But this piece went on to say, as the 21st century begins, Cecil Williams envisions a new church that no longer rejects members of our society. I want the church to be the church, he says. And it seems to me if it's going to be the church, it's got to stop turning its head away from poor folks. It's got to stop turning its head away from black folks, from brown folks, yellow folks, red folks, poor white folks. It's got to stop turning its head away from gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgender. It's got to stop turning its head away from children who are in desperate need. It's got to stop turning its head away from women who are going through all kinds of situations where empowerment is critical at this time. What I'm seriously saying is it's time for the church to be the church, and you always start out with those who are less fortunate, those who are in greater need. Middle-class America has got to recognize that it's got to go to the bottom to help folks help themselves. So just this radical, radical statement of inclusiveness and compassion. As I was saying before, compassion can be fierce. It's not wimpy. He has moved mountains to do the work that he's done, and it is still continuing at the church. And it's a movement of our interconnection, so not a separation. And so one of the beautiful things the Christian church can do is be that embodiment of compassion. So much good work has come and won't, a lot of challenges and difficulty from the church, from Christianity, but that's one of its, when people really follow the teaching, that's one of the core beliefs and engagement is to really help those less fortunate and to be an inclusive, welcoming place. And then I thought this was interesting. Some of you, I'm sure, know this story too, that Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is one of our most revered scholars and translators and teachers of Buddhism, you know, if you've met him, you'll know he is that. He's a scholar. He's deeply thoughtful. You know, you can tell that he spends hours in his office curled up with his books, and you can imagine him at a desk surrounded by piles of books. But a number of years ago, he saw that Buddhism wasn't engaging with real world suffering like other religions were doing. And he referenced Christianity and how many movements of caring have happened out of the church. So he wrote what he called an article called A Challenge to Buddhists. And he said, Buddhist teachers often say that the most effective way we can help protect the world is by purifying our own minds, or that before we engage in compassionate action, we must attain realization of selflessness or emptiness. There may be some truth in such statements, but I think it is a partial truth. In these critical times, we also have an obligation to aid those immersed in the world who live on the brink of destitution and despair. The Buddha's mission, the reason for his arising in the world, was to free beings from suffering by uprooting the evil roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. These sinister roots don't exist only in our own minds. Today, they have acquired a collective dimension and have spread out over whole countries and continents. To help free beings from suffering today, therefore, requires that we counter the systemic embodiments of greed, hatred, and delusion. So again, it was really a fierce call from one of our esteemed scholars and practitioners that this isn't just about sitting up on our quiet meditation hill retreat centers and purifying our own minds and hearts, as powerful that is. It's also about engagement. Now, we don't have to denigrate one or the other. What I think as wise practitioners is we do both. We recognize the power and the necessity of the purification of our own minds and hearts, and how much more clearly and effectively we can then act in the world. But act we must, because we are all in the world. We're not monastics separated from the world. Now, by that, I don't mean that all of us, it's a call to be on the front lines, or all of us need to be radical activists out protesting, but each of us to find our way to make the difference with the suffering that's right in front of us. So when Bhikkhu Bodhi put out that call. He has many students who are devoted to him. And so they took him up and they said, okay, Bhante, you said this, we want to do something. What should we do? Tell us what to do. And I'm sure he said back to them, well, you research it. But basically from his energy, his closest students, his board created a board. I don't know exactly how it happened, but his students and him researched how can they be most effective. And so they started an organization called Buddhist Global Relief many years ago now. I'm not sure, 5, 10 years ago. And they first started out with a very specific mission to alleviate hunger. They said, that's a really present and active cause of suffering for countless people in third world countries. But here in America, I mean, it's shocking that people, millions of people go to bed hungry. Millions of children can go to bed hungry in this country. They started doing charity walks where they was raise money through these walks. And now they've really broadened their response to many campaigns to directly alleviate suffering. So this is for all of us to consider as we develop this capacity, and especially when we're blessed and privileged, how can we help? I talked earlier about the heart, the awake mind, the awake heart being ceaselessly responsive. What are we called to do? And there's so much need out there, helping at a food bank, even working at a polling station. You know, it's endless the kinds of things that we can do. And we all have different capacities. Some of us need to really take care of ourselves. The virus, we may be in a vulnerable population, and that's totally okay. We need to be compassionate towards ourselves. But if we can help, how do we do that? How do we help? How does our practice come alive in the world? And this is a great area of exploration. I'm often talking to my friends about what can we do and what would be helpful. Where's the best way to use our energy? It's not easy. The needs are so great. You know, we offer support to all of these organizations, environmental, animal welfare, climate justice, things like that. There's always more to do. How do we find balance given the needs are so much, so great? And this is also, again, the representation of Kuan Yin. She hears the cries of the world, but her heart stays in balance. So this compassion is the responsiveness of the open, connected heart. How do we take it beyond the internal practice out into the world? You can be someone's pen pal or make phone calls or write letters. I've been writing postcards to Ohio and Texas and who knows what difference they make. But just that, you know, how can I help? How can I help? Could be your neighbor or someone in your family that could really benefit from a kind phone call, just to checking in, or an email, how are you doing? And we balance that, or we cultivate and we practice to bring to those connections our wisdom, our equanimity, so that we can actually stay engaged in a way that both supports the outer situation, but also supports our inner well-being. So again, this balancing, all the time, the balancing of how do we meet this situation? How do I stay present here? We're learning and we're training. I've always loved that we call this practice and training. We're not perfect and we don't have to wait until we're perfect. But how do I meet this moment? Starting with kindness for ourselves. I think all of us can feel overwhelmed or heavy at times. It's just too much. The barrage of news, bad news about politics, about the virus, about the climate, about animals. How do we hold that? It's the truth of this, of how it is. This is equanimity. This is how it is right now. How do I breathe and open to that and be kind, starting right here? So this is our challenge and our practice, and why I think practicing compassion is so valuable, to keep our hearts tender and open and to trust that if we can just meet this moment, we can meet the next moment too. We don't have to have it all figured out, know what the right thing to do is, or be, you know, again, on the front lines. We're just willing to keep showing up for ourselves and for others, for our inner life, for our friends, for our community, for the world. So, as our last meditation this afternoon, again, in the traditional way of teaching it, we would, in compassion, we'd start with the suffering person, and then we would move to self, and then we would go through all of the people we had chosen for our categories. And again, I'm sure you're familiar with the dear friend, the neutral person, even the difficult person we would express compassion towards. And there's a value, even, you know, there are some traditions that don't use those categories, don't even use the phrases. Again, also a powerful way to practice. But there's something so strengthening and purifying about bringing compassion to these different categories of beings. So even to your benefactor, who you might think of as having it all together or so wise or compassionate themselves. There's also suffering in that life, and our willingness to strengthen our heart and our capacity to open to that. Again, as a training, it's powerful. For our friends, obviously, we know their lives are complicated. They have a lot of beauty and joy, and they have challenge. But then to the neutral person, like we don't know them. We don't know their lives, but we do know that they have suffering. You can't live in this world and not have had suffering, perhaps be suffering now, or certainly will suffer in the future through old age, sickness, and death. So we know that about every single being. The neutral person is kind of the doorway or the representative of all beings. And then lastly, we practice with all beings, this full range of suffering. Can we open to that and hold that? And again, if I think, oh, I have to open to that, I have to hold that, how can I hold that? I can't. It's too much. That's where the powerful teaching anatta of selflessness, that there's nothing solid here. As long as I can tap into compassion and keep the channels open, that's all I need to do. I don't need to fix or hold in some conceptual way, everything. I just need to keep this channel of compassion open. And so compassion and emptiness really need to go together. And someone mentioned Venerable Analeo's book on compassion. It's on compassion and emptiness. Very scholarly. He's got a lot of sutta quotes, but highly recommend it. If you're interested in how these two teachings of compassion and emptiness go together, because it's emptiness that allows Kuan Yin to open to and hold all the suffering, because she sees the true nature of experience, that there's no solidity. It's all causes and conditions arising in this vast infinite space. The more we can tap into that, the more we can hold and open to the whole range, the vastness of the suffering. The Buddha said something like, all the tears you've cried over all your lifetimes would fill the four oceans. Just a sense of the vastness of the suffering over time. And not saying that to, you know, be a downer, to pull us down, but just to recognize this is a deep truth. And our willingness to take a breath and say, it's like this right now. May I meet this with openness and kindness. May I be strong and patient and kind with this suffering. Whatever phrase comes to you. So I thought, rather than going through all the different categories, which can get quite busy, we'll just do the opening to all beings in all directions. And I'll be emphasizing what we call the radiating form of the Brahma Viharas, where we don't so much use the phrases. We just, as best we can, drop into the quality that we're cultivating, in this case, compassion, and let whatever images or memories or connections come that keep that alive. But we don't drop into story. We don't, you know, try to imagine every kind of suffering there is out there and all the different kinds of beings. It's a very spacious, inclusive, open practice. And we do it to the four quarters, above and below, as they do in the chant. So hopefully that makes sense. And we'll begin again. If you need to stand up or make yourself comfortable for a period of meditation, please feel free. And beginning as we've done in our other sessions, just allowing the body to come into stillness, sense of uprightness, energy. Sometimes after lunch, it can be a little drowsy. Use your breath to energize, arouse the vital energy of the body. Let the spine be extended so you have a sense of uprightness. And then relax. Letting the eyes gently close. And inviting this sense of softness, comfort, allowing in the body. So the belly is soft and open, the jaw is relaxed, shoulders dropped. Any of the places you might hold tension, just check in with them and breathe and allow them to soften. Letting the attention rest in the chest area, perhaps the center of the heart. And in a spacious way, just feeling the breath moving in and out there. And it's the kind of tender attention that I've already spoken about. As James would say, a kind, relaxed, interested attention. Just in the breath, in the torso, in the chest, in the heart. And touching into, opening to this deep truth of suffering. The first noble truth, there is suffering. In any sentient being's life, there is or there will be suffering. All beings want to be happy, fear suffering. This openness to the suffering of the beings, human and non-human. This is the proximate cause for compassion. So whatever helps you open to, allow, support the Brahmavihara of compassion, this tenderness, the quivering of the heart in response to suffering. Perhaps it's a felt sense that you've had in one of the previous sessions or your just general experience of compassion. You know what that feels like. It's this bittersweet tenderness, a softness. Be a little heavy, but not in a dark way or a pulling down way. It just has a weight to it. And then as though that compassion, that feeling, that tenderness was like a light or a lamp shining out of your heart area. Let it shine out in the direction in front of you, like taking a quarter of the world and letting that light of compassion shine in front of you, touching any and all beings that you know through your imagination, through your familiarity, or in that direction, whatever direction you're facing, other people in your house, your neighbors, your community, fields with animals, four-legged and many-legged, the birds and the insects, the deer and the raccoons, all beings wishing to be happy, fearing suffering. Open to their reality that there is suffering with compassion. What are the phrases that speak to you? I care about your suffering. May you be free of suffering. May you find peace and ease in this suffering. If phrases are necessary just to help you connect with the intention, the motivation of compassion. But if they're not, just resting in that feeling of compassion, but feeling it radiate out in the direction in front of you. And all of the beings, known and unknown, human and non-human, seen and unseen, touching them with your heart and this caring, compassionate wish. May your suffering be eased. Again, not needing to say the words, but just this is the intention. There's suffering and we meet it with compassion. We hold it with equanimity and kindness. We don't pull away, but we don't get pulled in to the story, to the difficulty, to the enormity. We breathe. We just rest in this tender heart, that's willing to be with the suffering as best we know it in this direction. And if you find yourself getting pulled in to telling stories about all the suffering or collapsing or pulling back, again, hand on the heart. Go back to compassion for yourself if that would be helpful. Or perhaps just taking a breath, having Kuan Yin come and sit beside you and borrow her strength, her ease, her equanimity as you move again into expressing compassion for life in all its forms, human and non-human, seen and unseen, known and unknown, near and far, all beings in front of you. Keep it simple. Just compassion, compassioning. Not trying to do anything. Trying to feel any different. Just being willing to feel. Now you can see whether it feels better to you to, as though you were a lighthouse, and or you had a curtain in front of this lamp in your heart. You'd close the curtain to the front and now open it to the side, to your right. Or you could keep it open in the front and now also open to the side, whatever works. But just redirecting your attention to this quarter of the world. Suffusing this quarter of the world to your right, whatever you know is to your right. Again, could be people in your house, neighbors, countless houses if you're in a neighborhood, a suburb, a town, on to empty fields, farmland, woods, lakes. Knowing there are beings in that direction who are suffering right now. Human and non-human. All of the animals out there fearing for their life, trying to find safety, food, the wild animals, the farm animals with so no control over their lives, often in fear. All the animals of the earth, the birds of the sky. Beings of the waters, the fish, and crabs and otters and dolphins. Let your imagination open and expand to the right, like Google Earth, that map where you just fly and expand and breathe with this wish for easing of suffering. Easing of suffering, ending of suffering of all of these beings. Tender, responsive, balanced. Using your breath, staying relaxed, but letting your heart open, spacious and wide towards the right, expanding in that direction. This quarter of the world. And then shifting directions again, either closing the curtain or turning the beam or leaving it open, whatever works, but shifting the focus of your compassionate attention to behind you. Again, we use our imagination. We let our sense of the space behind us become vast, boundless, all the way behind us, that quarter of the world. As best you know it, all of the beings in that direction, holding them in this tender, compassionate embrace, recognizing the suffering, acknowledging the suffering. It's real. Yet finding your balance, breathing and opening. And sending these wishes, this intention, this Brahmavihara of compassion, all beings behind you. not trying too hard or trying to make something happen. Just allowing these tender wishes to expand behind you. But if you get lost or distracted, come back to where it's simpler. Connection to the breath and the body, mindfulness, metta, self-compassion. Do what works for you. Now again, shifting the focus to your left. It might be energetically different in that direction. More people or less people, more animals, fewer animals. All of the variety of people and beings in that direction to the left. Shifting the focus, letting the light of compassion move out in that direction. Those born and dying, people in homes and the homeless ones, two-legged and four-legged, many-legged, holding them all in this warm, soft embrace of compassion. May their suffering be eased. May they be held in kindness and care.